Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, our interview with Arthur Herman was really interesting, and part of his book discussed the movement, and we didn't talk about it with him, we didn't have time, but he talks in his book about people from Norway, Sweden, and Denmark emigrating to Wisconsin, and we're going to get into that a little bit more with Eleanor Brinskow, who is the lead genealogist and owner of Carlton Genealogical Services. She's experienced as a historian, a librarian, music editor. She teaches a genealogy course at UW-Madison, also vice president of the Dane County Area Genealogical Society. And as we talk with her about the kind of the Scandinavian genealogy and history of our state, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about Wisconsin Scandinavian history? What parts of Wisconsin culture do you think stem from Scandinavian ancestry? Love to have you join in. What have you learned looking into your own family's genealogy? Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Eleanor Brinskow, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you so much, Larry, for having me back on the air. I was actually also on Milwaukee Public Radio. I was an editor as well as a host on Lake Effect. So that was about almost 10 years ago now. So I'm excited to be back on the air on Wisconsin Public Radio's networks. So thank you for having me.
Well, I'm really glad you're here. Let's start with a bit of history here. When did people from Norway, Sweden, and Denmark begin immigrating to Wisconsin, and maybe a little about why?
Sure. So people started emigrating from the Scandinavia. It depends on which country you're talking about. So with Norway, they really started coming over. I do agree with Leif Erikson coming here way early on, but the actual emigrants came over in about 1825. That first boat was the Restoration, and the Restoration carried a boatload of people who were escaping for religious freedom. So they came over in 1825, and then they settled up in Kendall, New York. They're titled the Sloopers. So we had some religious freedom, but then we were also looking for more land. The Norway was incredibly poor at this point. They were losing a lot of money to Denmark and all the wars that Denmark was getting them involved with. However, then after Denmark was in control of Norway, then the control of Norway went over to Sweden. So then Sweden had a lot of debts to pay too. So we had religious freedom. We also had economics. Farmland was not good. And so coming to the upper Midwest was a great place to go for bigger tracts of land that was more fertile and can provide more cash crops. The Swedes and the Danish came over a little bit earlier, about the 1700s. One of the things that I had learned about those settlements is, especially in the New England areas, is that there wasn't a little New Norway. We had the Dutch coming over, we had New England, we had the French, the Spaniards, but we didn't have New Norway. We didn't have Little Norway. But the Swedes came over and the Danish came over. But how did they get to Wisconsin? What was happening is, as more people started coming over, especially in the 1860s, shortly after the Civil War, then they were getting kind of pushed out. They were looking for bigger tracts of land. They were looking for more land to be in. And so they moved westward. Looking at the maps, you can definitely see how the different immigrant communities were traveling in what was now basically 94, 1994, 1939. You can follow their tracks based on their settlements. You can follow them based on then the railroads built and the little towns, the settlements were built either along the railroads or the railroads were built to them so that they can be trading back and forth out east, having the crops being sent out east for more food for the new coming people. And so then they got to to Wisconsin. They started off in the Beloit area. They started off in Muskego, Wisconsin. And then they're going to work their way up to along Lake Michigan and then head on over to Koshkonong, Stoughton, then move westward into Minnesota and to the Dakotas. So that is really when they started coming over to Wisconsin, was going to be that time period between 1840 and 1870. There's a big chunk. But during that time, another thing we have to be considering is what was happening in America during that time. We have the Civil War with Colonel Haig. So we did have a portion of Scandinavian Americans fighting in the Civil War, but more people waited until after the Civil War to come over to become more settled. But then we also have the Homestead Act of 1862. The Homestead Act of 1862 was going to be promising settlers from all countries, but it really attracted to Danes and to the Norwegians. You know, if you come here and settle on this tract of land, you can have 160 acres for a very, very, very small price. And so then there's all these parcels of land that started getting built, taken and claimed. People would squat on them. And then over time, they would cultivate it to European standards. From there, they paid a little price. And then that was their land. You can also find out through the Bureau of Land Management if your ancestor was the very first settler, European American settler, on these tracts of land. They do have those records that are available for future genealogists or family historians.
Really, really cool. Mike in Milwaukee has a question for you.
Sure.
Mike, hi.
Hi, this is fascinating. The last caller or the last discussion was as well. I'm so happy that we're talking about Scandinavia. I'm Norwegian and my family's Norwegian, and they all settled in the Scandinavia, Iola, Amherst area. And one of the things that I always found interesting was that we have all of the pictures of my ancestors from all the way back in Norway that came just before the turn of the century. And nobody smiles. And I'm wondering if stoicism is a genealogy trait in the Norwegian culture.
Wow. Yes. It depends. So that turn of the century, sometimes it was chalked up to how long it took for the photo to develop. So I got married 6 years ago now, and over time throughout that day on my wedding day, my smile was just forced because of how long I had to smile, how many times I had to smile. So that was a part of it. It was a very serious, formal, photograph as well. And so most of the time that was how they were taken. The family photos were taken. They had to save enough money in order to get those photos taken. And so you better not screw it up. You had to sit there and be very professional. Good shot. Don't blink. So their eyes had to be wide open as they can. But then also, you know, Norwegians, I'm Norwegian American. And we don't want to be too friendly, of course. We don't want to come off too overt. So, of course, we have to stay nice and subtle. We're proud, but, you know, we can't be too proud because then that wouldn't be as Norwegian, right? So those would be a couple of the reasons why.
There you go, Mike. And it probably goes back to history, in history a bit, too. I mean, that's the kind of the way the ancestors were raised and lived, mm-hmm. kind of a community life, work hard, you know, those kinds of things.
Yes, they were very stoic as well. Yes, most of the Norwegians that came over were farmers. They wanted to farm. They didn't. There were in Norway, there are two really big types of jobs, of careers. You had the farmers and you had the fishermen. My ancestors were primarily fishermen. And so it was very dangerous. People lost their lives on being fishermen. So one branch of my Norwegian family came and settled in the Red River Valley, which is the western coast of Minnesota and the eastern portion of North Dakota. And they were just so glad that they had to just get off the boat finally. And there was flat land that was not going to move. So that was really nice. And so, yeah, they were coming over. They were hardworking. They wanted to establish something for themselves and for their future generations.
And, you know, when you think about Wisconsin and think about the climate, the foliage, the trees, I think there's some similarities there.
There definitely is. With Norway, it's much more mountainous. And so you have farm, like in Wisconsin, where you could just see for miles. In Norway, it wasn't that way. And so for Norwegians coming over to farm, it was completely different. Whereas in Sweden, you have a lot of trees, a lot of timber, and that eastern coast in Norway also had that too. And so we also have the Swedes and the eastern Norwegians coming over and settling in more forest areas of Wisconsin. So you're going to see more of that population in the northern part of Wisconsin, in the northeastern part of Minnesota as well. They're looking for those trees, those cash crops. That was what they were looking for because that's what they knew. So it depends on if they were looking for economics or they were looking for similarities. But in Norway and Sweden and also in Denmark, they have those nice long summer days. They also, where they have the sun is up for about 20 hours a day, if not longer. Whereas the winter, then it's basically you have 2 or 3 hours of sunlight. In Minnesota and Wisconsin, that's not the case. We have more seasons. We have a pretty set schedule with how long the sun is going to be up. So there are differences, but it was close enough to home. But another reason why they settled in the upper Midwest is because many of the Scandinavian immigrants came and they got checked in at the port in Quebec. Instead of Ellis Island, instead of Castle Garden, which is the predecessor of Ellis Island. Ellis Island didn't start until the late 1890s. It was Castle Garden before that. And so a lot of people are looking, oh, my ancestor came through Ellis Island. Actually, not really. Most likely not. There are other ports to look at, too.
So then, and we can talk some more.
Quebec. Yep.
And we could talk some more about that. We need to take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. Then we'll be back with Eleanor Brinscoe, lead genealogist and owner of Carlton Genealogical Services. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Taking a look now at Wisconsin Scandinavian history, learning about the early settlers' lives, how their culture affects us here in Wisconsin right today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Eleanor Brinscoe, a lead genealogist and owner of Carlin Genealogical Services. She has experience as a historian, librarian, music editor. She also teaches a genealogy course at UW-Madison. Maybe you have Scandinavian history. What questions do you have about that history? What do you want to know and ask a genealogy expert? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Number of callers online, maybe we should take some calls here. Chris in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Larry, and hi, Eleanor.
Hello.
I'm just calling in to ask a question about names.
Okay.
Norwegian names specifically.
Yep.
I'm an amateur genealogist for my own family, and I know that where my name comes from is actually a Danish spelling as opposed to the traditional Norwegian spelling. My name is Christensen.
With an S-E-N or S-O-N?
C-H-R-I-S-T-E-N-S-E-N. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And so the story in my family is that, oh, well, one of my grandfathers just changed it. And I'm just wondering, was that really popular when people weren't coming through Ellis Island, where people just like changed their identity?
Right. And so that's one of the biggest myths in genealogy and with family historians just starting out is, oh, well, my ancestors changed their name at Ellis Island. It cannot happen. It could not happen. Here's why. The ship manifest that the passenger list that was created when the passengers got on the boat were written down by people who spoke the language. They understood the spellings, the characteristics. That spelling had to match when it got over to a U.S. port. They had to match identically unless if somebody had passed away on the boat or if somebody was born on the boat on the way over, which did happen. So they couldn't change the name at Ellis Island. They couldn't change it at Castle Garden. They couldn't change it at a port. Eventually, what would happen is the ancestor can then change the name so that when the census taker came around, they could change it then. They can change it through naturalization records when they wanted to see, they decided, oh, I wanted to Americanize the name. And sometimes the census taker didn't understand the dialect that was happening. And so they would just kind of guess. So sometimes that's another reason why it's hard to find the ancestor in census records. But they might have seen your ancestor, or the ancestor might have seen, oh, I like that spelling. And so they just stuck with it. Or maybe the ancestor couldn't read. And so they were just relying on these government officials writing out the name for them. And then the ancestor would just make his mark, and they would say his mark, her mark. So it's not necessarily going to happen at these U.S. ports because it couldn't. What they could do, they can choose to have a different spelling, or they just went with the spelling. And then as the descendants were being more literate, they spoke English, they could read English, then they just stayed with it. So no, it was not happening at the port. There are a couple of different reasons to choose why they wanted that spelling.
Yeah. Interesting. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate it. Dennis in Two Rivers, your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I was just wondering, since you talked about farming, I was just thinking with a little bit of sunshine, I don't know how much growing they could do, but they had a lot of water, so I think they'd have to rely on fishing quite a bit. And as a related issue, is eating lutefisk done because it tastes good, or is it just a test to see how tough they are?
Well, when I went over to Norway in 2017, I learned a lot. And one of the things I learned is that Norwegians do not eat lutefisk anymore. So it's just kind of a cultural tradition in America, and especially in the upper Midwest, where different churches and the Sons of Norway lodges are offering the lutefisk. But I think it's a matter of being tough and honoring that pride. And if by gum, if my grandfather can do it, so can I. So I think there's a lot of that.
There we go. But what about this whole business of the agriculture and the fish, fishing versus agriculture?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so it really depended on the location of where the ancestor lived. So I have two traced lineages back to Norway. One was a fisherman. They did have a farm to kind of supplement, but it was a small tract of land. But then you also have, I have another ancestor who was farther south, who did have a larger tract of land. One of the things that I've learned is that there is a lot of sun happening during the summer months, and so they do have different crops. They have different styles of seeds, and so it is acclimated to the climate there. But it's a little different from American farming as how we know it. So they also had to get acclimated to what we were using, or what the indigenous people of America were using as well. But then there's also a lot of rain. It's a very rainy place in Norway, especially. And so they had to work with it. Those crops and the farms were small, and they still are small. They had this rule, the Norwegian government, as it was, had this rule where if a father dies, then they split up that chunk of that farm into different chunks so that each son and then eventually each daughter could inherit it. And then it got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. It got to the point where they can sustain them, their family, but they couldn't make anything out of it. They couldn't make any enough crop, enough return to go sell at a different farmer's market to gain a little extra money to pay the rent for the people who were owning that land if it wasn't their dad. Whereas the fishermen got to pile up all, and whether it's fishermen or whale fishermen, got to go and they would collect all their big crops. They would sail those crops of fish, their harvests, down to Bergen, and then they would be able to trade. So fishermen came out more prosperous because they didn't have to rely on a small tract of land, but they can also go down and trade with people who were coming in from other countries to buy up what the Norwegians had. But then therefore, they can also buy what the different merchants from the different countries were bringing in too. So...
there you go. Let's go to Janelle in Green Bay. Thank you for calling, Janelle.
Thanks for having me on the show, Larry. I know that my great-grandmother came to Wisconsin in 1902 and that she was 25 at that time. Mm-hmm. She lived in the Iola, Scandinavia area also, which I found interesting connecting to the earlier caller who said his Norwegian relatives lived in that same area. I had always presumed that it was more Swedish than Scandinavian in general, but that makes sense to me. She really didn't communicate a whole lot with her siblings when she left. And so with the advent of the internet and some family members doing the tracing, we reconnected with a number of the Swedish relatives. So that would be her siblings' descendants. And over the course of the last, I'd say 15 to 20 years, a number of them have come to the U.S. and visited and attended our family reunions during the summer, which has been a lot of fun. Probably about 7 of them have made the trip back and forth, some of them frequently. And 3 years ago, in 2018, my youngest daughter, who was 13 at the time, and I made the decision to just take that big trip that we had always talked about taking. And so we flew into Stockholm and met cousins there. And for 3 weeks, they moved us from cousin to cousin, family to family, across the country from Sweden to the home country. My great-grandmother was from a little area called Norrbo. And so we were able to visit the home that she actually grew up in, which is still inhabited by some distant cousins. But through the course of that 3 weeks, we met 72 new cousins and were completely graciously and generously hosted and taken care of by them. And they remain now, thanks to the internet and Facebook and video calls and Facebook Messenger, they remain some of the dearest family members that I have.
Oh,
wonderful.
That's a great story, isn't it? And it's a little about the culture again, I think. You know, here's Janelle and her daughter being graciously and lovingly received by, you know, like her community of relatives.
Right. Absolutely. And you're right about with the internet being able to connect with so many people and then just taking that leap of faith and just going in there. Yes, Larry said, like, the culture over in Norway and Sweden and Denmark are very friendly, very welcoming. They want, the thing also over there is that they want to know what happened to us. What happened to our ancestors who left and were their descendants? I've actually, when I went over in 2017, I was kind of put on display. It was very interesting because my cousins who spoke English said, okay, well, we're going to send you up to this other part of Norway. You're going to get to meet all these people. Wonderful. But the problem is they were older and they couldn't speak English. And so we sat there looking at each other kind of... Oh, they're the Americans. Oh, they're Norwegians. But one of the things with the people who were able to speak English well enough so that we can translate for each other is that they don't know what Ancestry.com is. And that was really fascinating to me because I went over there. Okay, well, I have my family tree on Ancestry. And they're, what's that? And so it turns out that most of their research is on MyHeritage. They have their whole tree on MyHeritage, which is another database I believe was founded in Israel. And it's global. And so you're able to use these different research methods on there as you do on Ancestry.com, as you do on FamilySearch.org, which is a free website for genealogists and family historians. And so then that I keep up that subscription and I've put my DNA into MyHeritage so that way I can get more ancestors and more descendants, get more information that's happening over, especially in Norway, that I'm not getting on my Ancestry.com subscription. So that's really important. But to also keep in touch with these people, I've created different groups. I have a group for each different line of my family tree so that I can stay in touch with my cousins so that we can share. I can ask questions. Hey, here's this photograph of somebody. Does anybody know who this is? Oh, yeah, this is somebody. Oh, okay. So it's a good way to use social media as well as Ancestry, as well as your different emails and different genealogy subscriptions if you have more than one. So things to think about. But yes, I love that they're able to just stay in touch. And some, yes, they're wonderful people over there. Yes.
Thanks, Janelle. Warren in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Warren.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Eleanor.
Hello.
I was mowing my lawn, and when I heard you were from the Red River Valley, I just dropped everything and had to come in because I want to inject a little bit of a humor for you.
Good.
Because you would know this area, and most people wouldn't, and they wouldn't believe me. I graduated from Fertile High School.
Yep. Yep, yeah. I know where that is. You bet I do. My ancestors were outside of Crookston and Fisher, Minnesota. So that's where we were.
I grew up on a farm just south of Crookston.
Okay, there you go. Yep.
My dad was Swedish and my mom was Norwegian, which was never supposed to be able to get together. You know, there wasn't supposed to be a mix there.
Yes.
But it worked out beautifully for both of them. At least I hope so. And yeah, and that area, I understand why Fertile is named Fertile, because people didn't really have a handle on the language quite the way we do now, and all the jokes that have come that we've endured for the last 30, 40 years. And we've heard them all.
Warren.
I just had to get that in there because I knew you would know the area. So fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Well, little program we have going here. So, yeah.
Thank you. Yep, because you also have Fertile, Minnesota. You also have Climax, Minnesota. So that we have very interesting names up in that part of the state. Yes, we do.
There we go. Warren, thanks. Oh, man. Jan in Madison, your turn.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My ancestors came from Stavanger, and I believe they entered through Quebec. And just before you had your break, you started to talk about that. I don't know much about that. Could you tell me more about entering the U.S. through Quebec? Did they stop first in New York? And was there a U.S. port of entry office in Quebec? And where did they go from Quebec?
So, yes. So what they would do is they stopped in New York for a little bit, and then they would go up into Quebec. So they would follow the Erie Canal. They would go through Hudson Bay. They got to Quebec. They stopped there. And then they could go by foot. They could go by rail, by wagon. And then they would go westward. Some went southern, down south, but most of them went westward. So they were settling in northern Minnesota and in North Dakota, or the Dakota Territory at that point. Was there a U.S. port of entry there? They could come through there. They were, they were saying, "Well, what's your destination?" "Well, I'm planning to go to Minnesota." "Okay." And so they would write in ship manifest, or the passenger arrival list. Sorry, they would write in there what their destination was, and then they would work their way through. They didn't have big gates going across the state borders, so they didn't have that. They just entered through, and then they would go check in at the different county offices of the state or the territory that they were entering into, saying, "Yeah, I'm here. I want to do this." "Okay, great. I'm going to go squat on some land." "Great." So that's how they would do that. Those records are available on Ancestry.com and on Family Search, which Family Search seems to be a lesser known database for genealogy researchers, but it's free. You just create a free account. It is operated by the Church of Latter-day Saints, but you don't need to be a member of that religion in order to access those materials. So I like to play the two databases off of each other, because if one just has an index where they type it all up, the other likely has the actual image of the actual document. So definitely use both of those, but it should be researchable on either one of those websites.
Thank you very much for that call. Appreciate it, Jan. Shannon in Madison, your turn.
Hi, I have a question that I've always wondered about. My great-grandparents came from Norway in approximately 1880 to southern Minnesota. And my great-grandmother could not read or write. And the story was always told that she was considered gifted in Norway. And so because she was considered exceptionally gifted in Norway, they assigned her a lesser student, per se, to do her reading and writing. She was to focus on the arts, and she could do her arithmetic. And I have never heard this from anybody else, and I was just wondering if you'd ever come across this.
I have not come across that at all. And that sounds very interesting. You said from Stavanger. And so that's going to be one of the larger cities in Norway. It was a big port city. And that was also kind of a minor port where people would leave from Stavanger to go to a larger port to then come and immigrate to America. So with that being a port city, one of the things I would definitely look into is what their lifestyle was over in Stavanger, if they may be Danish immigrants who had settled there a generation or two before because of the Danish nobility coming in and getting larger tracts of land in Stavanger. And then maybe it's just a money thing. Maybe they have the money to hire somebody to take that on. That would be my guess. That would be the first step I would look into if I were taking on a case like that, as far as genealogy is concerned. So, but no, I've not heard a case like that. But that would be my guess, my first place to look.
There you go. Well, Tracy emailed, and she says she disagrees with you about that. It's no, that lutefisk is no longer eaten in Norway. It lives on strong. Her husband's family all live in Norway, and every year they go in November to have a lutefisk party. They all enjoy it immensely. They find that here in the U.S. the problem is that people don't know how to prepare it correctly. When correctly prepared, it's delicious, just as good as any salted fish you can find.
Okay, good to know. Yeah, maybe my relatives and the people who live in their towns just don't do it. They do. My relatives do eat sheep's head, though. They will eat that. But I have not found a Norwegian yet who eats lutefisk. But maybe there is that portion that does.
Well, I've had it at some church suppers, and I've also had it in a restaurant in Madison. And the preparation in the Madison restaurant was much different. And to my taste, it was a lot better. And I enjoyed it much more, that's for sure. Well, tell me about your genealogicals. You're the owner of Carlin Genealogical Services. What do you do for folks?
So what I do for folks is I have taken on over the last more than 20 years, but then I started my business in 2015, is I will do family history research for them. I've gotten questions from like, oh, I want to know everything about my family, to I'm looking for the specific answer for this one question I have. Over time, my business has really shifted to having more of a Scandinavian focus, especially if it's connected to Minnesota or Wisconsin or the upper Midwest. Over at least the last year, I've been able to do more Zoom presentations and giving presentations to historical societies, to family reunions, to genealogy societies, to public libraries, private libraries. And actually, a couple weeks ago, I did a presentation at the Trelog Stevna, which was a group of people who are interested in genealogy from a particular part of Norway. And I gave a presentation on Norwegian folklore. So I do a lot of more presentations now than I do with the research itself. And then I also have a day-long workshop at the Wisconsin Historical Society on Norwegian genealogy. So head on over to wisconsinhistory.org to learn more.
And if you have another question, maybe you can post that question over there as well. That would be another way to do it. I know there are some more questions here. Eleanor, always a pleasure. Thanks. I hope you'll come back and be with us again.
I would love to be back. Thank you so much, Larry, and to the listeners today. I really appreciate it.
Eleanor Brinsko, a lead genealogist and owner of Carlin Genealogical Services. Great to have her with us today. It was a fun show all the way through. I really enjoyed it. Hope you did too. Tomorrow it's Garden Talk. Doug Soldat comes back to talk with us about lawns, especially turf in the fall season, and lawn renovation. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.